This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the forthcoming novel Brotherless Night.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And today we're talking to a friend, and in your case, a classmate.
That's right. Lan Samantha Chang and I were classmates at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I have this very clear, I don't know if I've ever told you this, Sugi, I have this very clear visual memory of meeting her on the interior staircase of some, like, rickety house in Iowa City, and the encounter had something to do with a vacuum cleaner. That's all I can remember, although I hope we'll ask her if that's accurate. My memory is not as good as it used to be.
That's so funny. My first encounter with Sam was when I was in my final year at Iowa. She had to give like a master class, and she chose an excerpt from Brotherless Night, actually, to workshop as part of her interview. And she gave me just amazing advice and encouragement, and we've been in touch off and on ever since.
Lan Samantha Chang is the award-winning author of the collection Hunger and the novels Inheritance and All is Forgotten, Nothing is Lost. A recent Berlin Prize Fellow, she has also received grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation. She is the first Asian American and first female director of the Iowa Writers Workshop, and she lives in Iowa City.
We had her on this show back in 2017 to talk about the struggles facing public universities in Midwestern states, and now we're having her back to talk about how to construct new narratives about immigration and her fantastic new novel, The Family Chow. Sam, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Whit, regarding your earlier story about the vacuum cleaner, I just have to say here that my life hasn't changed at all. Like 30 years after that, I'm still in Iowa City. But the technology for vacuum cleaners has gotten much better.
But am I right about the vacuum cleaner? Did I remember that correctly?
I think you are. Okay. I think you are correct. Right. But what I'm trying to remember is, like, what did I need? Why would I need a vacuum cleaner?
I'm surprised that I had one. That's the thing that's amusing to me.
Yeah, that's also insane. But I think that my neighbor had my downstairs neighbor had an apartment with a rug that used to belong to Ethan Kanan. And maybe that's what we needed it for.
The story is very Iowa City.
Yeah.
All right. So much of your drama in your book centers on the Fine Chow, a restaurant run by the family of the title. In my neighborhood, there's a popular local Chinese restaurant called Kin Lin. I've had hundreds of meals there over 20 or 30 years. So I haven't moved much, just as you have not moved much from Iowa City. Kansas City's been my home and was where I was born. I've always thought when I go in that there's a story here that I don't know, and there's like this full complicated life happening, you know, there in the kitchen and behind the counter of the restaurant, you know, and I want to figure out what it's like, and suddenly here's your novel that does just that. How did you decide to choose food as an organizing theme here?
I mean, I didn't actually start with the theme. I started with the setting, and the setting started with the story. So I wanted to write a succession story, and I had to consider the question of what would be the object of contention, and so I thought about a family business, which, of course, led to the consideration of a restaurant because, you know, a restaurant is one of the quintessential immigrant family businesses. Also, as a location, the restaurant seemed like a great setting place for some of the major scenes. And then finally, I'm obsessed with eating. My parents were immigrants new to Wisconsin back in the 60s and 70s, early, you know, in the mid 60s, there was nothing Asian to eat in Wisconsin. My parents had to go to Chicago and buy, you know, big supplies like soy sauce. And then they would come back to Wisconsin and buy their groceries at the Red Owl supermarket, and they would stir fry lettuce, iceberg lettuce, and things like this. So we've all, as a family, been obsessed with food for decades, particularly Chinese and Chinese-American food.
So there are, of course, like lots of opportunities and also complications to writing about food. I'm thinking here, I have a friend who's an academic who writes about food and literature, Anita Munnor. And so one of the plot points of the novel, which we're going to be vague about to avoid spoilers, involves the white fascination with the old racist trope that Chinese and Chinese Americans like to eat dog meat. And I'm really curious to hear you talk a little bit about how you write about a particular national cuisine whose surface, as Witt points out, is so prevalent in America that it becomes a cliche. How do you subvert the cliche rather than reinforcing it?
I mean, ultimately, I didn't start with the idea of the dog meat. It arose out of my drafts, and I think that it really came out of the humor that I was using in the book. The book has a different tone from a lot of my earlier work, and it's broader than my earlier work. And so I was able to use humor. I was able to include the cliche and make it ridiculous through the use of humor. So I would say that I thought about using an outsider perspective ultimately to create a comedic distance and provide a slant on American culture. I also used, you know, with the dog meat, I wanted to incorporate all different perspectives. I used different voices, particularly in the second half of the book, there's a comment section. I wanted to provide a kind of dissonant Greek chorus to the story that was happening.
The book is really, really funny.
Thanks.
The other thing that's nice about, a restaurant as a physical setting is that lots of things can happen, right? There are physical places, there's a freezer, there's, So you have that sort of that dynamic. I'm just surprised. I'm trying to think, and maybe you'll tell me one that I'm completely foolishly ignoring. I couldn't think of a novel set that used it as the central location, a Chinese restaurant before.
I think there are a couple. I just don't remember what they're called. They're not books that I've spent a lot of time reading.
Yeah.
So, it was new for me as well. I think
it surprised me when I thought about that, because I think it seems like such a great place to set a book if you were going to, and I didn't know why that was. But anyway, I'm glad that you went ahead and have done that. Filled that gap.
Thanks,
I can think of a couple. I'm wondering, Sam, if any of the ones you're thinking of. I mean, I recently taught Celeste Ng's Little Fires Everywhere, which has like a Chinese restaurant that plays like sort of a role in the plot. And then there's Lillian Lee's Number One Chinese Restaurant, which is actually set near where I grew up in Maryland. And so I was kind of like, as I was reading your book, could I teach a whole class that has to do with this?
Number One Chinese Restaurant I haven't heard of. I don't know that book.
It's great. It's a great book, but
no, I was thinking about Babette's Feast.
Oh, okay.
Like Isaac Dinesen, I was thinking, about the food reading that I've done as I was growing up and learning to cook. I found Babette's Feast particularly interesting because it's basically about the preparation of a big meal. And so is my book.
Mm.
So one of the first, one of the first ideas I had for a book that became this book, and first idea that went into this, I found it in my journal from a million years ago. It was the story takes place in one evening. It is a huge dinner party. That was what I wrote in my log. And essentially, that's what happens in this book. It's about the preparation for a huge dinner party and then the aftermath of the party.
It's so funny to mention Babette's Feast. I wonder how many people, that's like our generation movie. I remember my uncle, who was a painter, coming and telling me, like, you got to see this movie, Babette's Feast. It's really great. And going to see it at the Art House Theater in Kansas City.
Yeah, I think I've seen the film, but what I read over and over was the Dinesen tale.
Oh, I actually have never read that.
It's really good.
Okay, so this book is an homage, speaking of other famous books, also an homage to Brothers Karamazov, and you have a funny pun on that in the book. And that novel, like yours, is beautifully populated. The patriarch and matriarch of the Chow family are Winnie and Leo. They have three sons. Is it Dagu? Is that the right way to say that?
Dago.
Dago. Ming.
Means big dog.
Dago, Ming, and James. Can you sort of introduce our listeners to your characters and explain their various romantic entanglements?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. The romantic entanglements. There's three brothers. So the oldest is Dago, big dog, and he is involved with two different women. His fiance, Catherine, and the new love of his life, Brenda. And Dago and Catherine have been together for 12 years, and she's like a member of the family, of the Chow family. And Dago wants to break up with her, and he wants to date this hot American white woman, Brenda. But Catherine won't let the relationship end because she values her connection to the Chinese American family, the Chows. Catherine is of Chinese descent, but she's adopted. She's especially attached to Dago, not Dago, but his mother, Winnie, who's like the mother, the Chinese mother she never had. But then Winnie has three sons and no daughters. So Catherine is like the daughter that Winnie never had. Ming, the middle son, is pretty much in love with Catherine, which would solve all of the problems. And she's perfect for him. But he can't date her because of his own self-hatred. He won't date Asian women. And the irony is that Catherine, of course, was raised in a white family outside of Asian culture. She just looks Asian. And then finally, there's James, the youngest son, and Alice, his childhood sweetheart. And that is one of the sort of long lines of the book, like James is sort of falling in love with Alice and what happens.
It is such a great dynamic to watch play out for over the course of the book, all of those, the dynamic between Catherine and Ming and Dago. And I wonder if you would read a little bit for us.
Sure. This is hilarious. So it's the end of the school year, and yesterday I cleaned my desk and I took every copy I had of the Family Chow and moved it, like, I don't know where. And so now I have to use the British edition. Okay. Let's see. You would like me to read this section where Catherine and Ming are sort of having one of their typical, I don't know, arguments? Okay, great. I have to say, this is fairly far into the book. It's page 184, and a lot of stuff has happened in the book. At O'Hare Airport, Catherine executes a perfect pickup on the arrivals curb, but the pleasure of being met at the airport is destroyed by her jabbering about family matters. Ming has to bite his lip to keep from rattling out a stream of critique. She is as bad as the most racially deprived white person fetishizing Asian culture. Her interest in Dago, in the Chow family, is entirely due to her sense of deprivation after having been raised as a racially Chinese in a white, well-meaning but white American family. Can't she get over it? Can't she even be grateful for the total blissful wipeout of the self-abnegation, the anxiety, the shameful graspingness of immigration? Rather than missing out, Catherine has been fast-forwarded, and yet she chooses, stubbornly, idiotically, to push the rewind button by worshiping their family. She's unaccountably sorrowful about the deaths of his parents, even his father. Are you sad? She asks Ming, tearily. He glowers at her profile. She's focused on the road, responsible driver that she is. No one else would have the gall to ask that question of him. Keeping his voice level, he replies that people need to mourn in their own time. He takes out his phone to avoid more talk, but she doesn't notice. Is he getting enough sleep? Is everything all right with his health? I'm fine, he says. I need a cup of coffee. I'm sure you're fine, she says after they pull into a Starbucks, but you look simply awful. I've got to take a call, he says, hoping to end the conversation. Is it Dago? She blushes. I mean, are you going to talk to Dago? Are you? He's busy, she says. My therapist says this is a hard time for him. In his New York life, his adult life, Ming has the luxury of an even temper, but an hour with Catherine and he can't control himself. Does your therapist try to make you forgive him? He gulps the coffee, burning his mouth. Does she say it's all a process? Catherine stops at the car and bends over her sneaker, slender fingers making clean white shoestrings into perfect loops. Ming imagines her as a child, learning to tie her shoes, stubbornly making rabbit ears. The vision fills him with rage. He presses on. Why do you idolize him? Why do you idolize us? He asks, wrenching open the door to the passenger seat. You've got to know by now, Catherine, that just because we're biologically connected, and although we're 100% Chinese American, our family is a clusterfuck. We're lost. My parents' marriage was indisputably lost, and Dago's lost. He's a disaster. Only a genuine miracle will pull him out of it. Even James, his life is going to be lost the moment he grows up enough to know his ass from his elbow. And I, you, are filled with self-hatred. You're as racist as any extremist bigot. She gets into the car, but doesn't start the engine. Instead, she turns and glares at him. He's alarmed, not by what she's just said. She's probably right. But by the side of her face, Catherine is pale, her eyes filled with tears, and even though he knows she was raised by a husky Corcoran blonde, her emotional palate is not his mother's. Not a drop of her upbringing bleeds Chinese. Despite this knowledge, he is seized with the kind of pain only Winnie makes him feel. In its pain, he would give anything, any amount to escape. Has given. Catherine starts the car and pulls back onto the highway, avoiding his gaze. You idolize him, he repeats. You think I do, she says, her voice shaking. You think I worship him and all of you. You think I humiliate myself clinging to an imagined family I never had. I've got to get out of here, Ming says. I can't stand this for one more minute. I have a loving family, she says. Ming leaps at this. Exactly, he says. They love you. You all treat each other way better than anyone in my family treats each other. And they support my relationship with Dago. They want me to be connected to my Chinese identity. What Chinese identity? Ming shouts. To his horror, she looks again like a little girl. He sees her at 6 years old, standing on the playground, watching the sun shine on the blonde hair of her classmates. He can't stand it. Even though he's been there, is familiar with the origins of self-hatred, knows he can't bear it because it reminds him of himself. He can't speak to her anymore. He puts his headphones on and turns up the sound. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Just every exchange with them is amazing. There's so many juicy fights in this book. So that question, what Chinese identity, seems central to the novel. And it seems to me like the book is trying to define a new way of thinking about Chinese identity and the immigrant experience in general, right? There's that line that makes sense, 100% Chinese American. And yes, you know, Chinese restaurants were a real way for first generation Chinese Americans like Leo to get a foothold in the country. And his story is part of the first wave of stories about Chinese Americans, but the stories of the children, and that sort of seems like what Ming is getting and what the book is getting at, the stories of the children are very different, and those stories haven't been told as often.
Sure. I mean, Ming has been, you know, raised in Haven, Wisconsin, and he just beat it out of there the minute he turned, you know, the minute he graduated from high school. He went to college on the East Coast. He took a job in New York. He works in a bank. He is just avoiding, like, everything to do with his family. But, of course, he's still deeply attached to his family. And the things that happened to him as he was growing up in Haven still, in some ways, haunt him. I wanted to write about long-term immigration and to show how each of the siblings in the family is really different from, you know, the others, depending on what their position was relative to their parents' acclimation and changing expectations about what it would be like to be American. So Dago, the oldest, he was the sort of like precious oldest son. They spoil him. He goes out into the world and he can't understand why everything doesn't work out for him because he has such high expectations. His parents were so filled with hope when they were raising him. And so eventually he ends up coming back home to the restaurant and working there for his dad, which leads to the entire, you know, plot of the novel, the conflict. Ming, on the other hand, as I was saying, desperately wants to leave home, but is drawn back to it. And James is an interesting character because in some ways he's Chinese. He loves his parents despite their complications, but he, culturally Chinese, we're supposed to love our parents and do everything for them. But James doesn't speak Chinese because he's, you know, the third child. His parents were super busy by the time he was little and his brothers brought him up and they spoke to him in English. So there are three very different stories, and I wanted to capture all of them in the book.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. I don't want to go all Terry Gross here, but I was wondering how your relationship with your family is these days. You know, there's so many parallels. You left home, right, and went to school on the East Coast, similarly to Ming. So how are things, you know, like, to what extent are you drawing on personal experience in this book?
I mean, I think that dynamic of leaving home and sort of like changing a lot is definitely part of my life and my sister's lives. My parents desperately wanted us to grow up and leave Wisconsin. Like, I think it was one of the most selfless things they did, to tell us that we should get out of there. We grew up.
So that's different in some ways than what certainly what, I don't know. Yeah, Leo doesn't. I can't remember whether he advises the kids to leave or not. He seems like he wants them around.
I think he likes bossing them around. I think he mostly just wants them to like have big lives. He wants his kids to have a lot of lovers, for example. He wants them to spread their seed all over the country, and he wants them to just have big, big accomplishments and hopes and dreams, and, you know, because that's the way he is. And I would say that in some ways that was like my dad. My dad was also very charismatic, and he died in 2020 when I was writing the book. My mom also died while I was writing this book. So I think in a way, my interest in long-term assimilation was due to my experiencing the question that I'd always had, which was, when my parents die, who will I be? They were the connection to China and to this very complicated story about which I knew very little when I was growing up, because they didn't talk about it. And I think in some ways my life as a writer has been an attempt to excavate that, but also to... to describe the aftermath of their decisions to, you know, be here in the U.S. and raise their family here. I can't remember if I answered your question.
Oh, I was just going to say, it was so interesting for me to read and see different aspects of, I think that a lot of people rightly contest sort of the term Asian American is like this giant umbrella term that arose from these moments of, American created political solidarity that arose out of like discrimination, et cetera. But then there was so much here that I did recognize, right? Like Ming, for example, knows Chinese, but he also studies it, right? And then I thought about, you know, all of the quote unquote like heritage learners, which is the term, right? Where you've grown up around a language, but you maybe don't read it. You maybe can't generate the speech yourself. And so you, I don't know, go to university and sign up for a class that meets 5 days a week at 9 a.m. And you do for that what you wouldn't do for your parents, or what you should have or couldn't, or I don't know, for whatever reason. And then I was like, oh, I'm there a little bit in Ming. And then Ming is a little bit like, James is kind of a sucker because he really loves his family. And I was like, oh God, that's me too. and so I was seeing like all of these commonalities. And one of the things that I so admired about the book, like going back to that humor, that playfulness, the way that it does play with those tropes and subvert them. And I was thinking of our mutual friend Peter Hodavies and some of his work, which also has this kind of like playfulness with like history and tropes. And then in this particular case, right, it's three sons. So there's also a lot in there about like Asian masculinity, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
And like, at, you know, Big Chow, Leo Chow, wants his sons to go spread their seed over the country. And also, you know, in a very early scene, like James gets, he hears a racist slur from like local kids who are connected to his family. But then there are also places where some of these stories, like James and Fang, his family, a family friend, they talk about a racist children's book. But then they kind of repurpose the story to turn it in a different way. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about some of that writing and kind of turning those tropes and masculinity.
I mean, the racist, masculinity, I am sort of frustrated by the way that Asian masculinity is portrayed in American popular culture, as many people are. Just as an Asian woman who grew up in a family with like very strong, you know, male characters, like my mother's brothers, my father, my cousins. I just wanted to write a book in which the male characters had love lives. Like, complicated, interesting love lives that were not, that were just complicated, interesting love lives. So in terms of the racist children's book, that is a book called The Five Chinese Brothers. I don't know if either...
I definitely remember that book.
I do too.
That was in the reading curriculum when
yes,
I was...
Yes, me too. I don't remember this.
Yes, because I think it was...
I think it was taken out by the time you got
exactly,
there.
Exactly. So some of us remember this book, and it... You know, you can still buy this book. I found it in a bookstore while I was writing the book, my novel, and I thought, oh my God, I remember this. And then I started thinking, I realized when I reread it, that the book is very similar to The Brothers Karamazov. So both books contain multiple brothers of Chinese descent. Both books contain a trial. In both books, the brothers try to sub in for each other to protect each other from guilt. I mean, the racist thing about the five Chinese brothers is that they all look exactly alike. And the pictures are, the illustrations are sort of appallingly comic in that they all do look exactly alike. Sugi, you've never seen this.
I don't think so. Oh, or wow. maybe my subconscious has just blocked it out.
No, no. You must not have seen it. It's a classic. So I just wanted to talk about it. I wanted to talk about it in the book. And, it was just the perfect opportunity. There's a trial in my novel as well. So preparing for the trial.
There's also a repurposing there, which I find is interesting, sort of taking a thing and then using it in a productive manner, which seems very McPherson-y to me.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I also wanted to talk about, surprise, the Midwesternness of this novel. When you were last on the show, we talked about Midwestern land-grant schools and the novel Stoner, which is set at the University of Missouri. You set the family chow in a small Wisconsin town. As we've said, you're from Wisconsin yourself. What does the Wisconsin setting give you that a setting in New York or LA or Seattle doesn't or wouldn't?
So this is the thing. Nobody asks why writers set work in New York, LA, or Seattle. I mean, I just feel that, like the South, the Midwest is this enormous part of our country that many members of the American intelligentsia and coastal elites don't know anything about. And it's been that way for a long time. And it's as we can see, this ignorance is actually hurting the entire country. And it
helps to think of the Midwest also as Sugi and I talk about this all the time. It's a diverse place, right?
Yeah.
And so the imagination, part of the ones ways that the coastal elites imagine the Midwest is as a purely white area.
Yeah. No, and Sugi, you were talking about Asian Americans, the term Asian American being this, you know, sort of basket description of a bunch of really disparate people and cultures, but I would argue that the American, Asian American experience in a place like Wisconsin is a completely different experience than the Asian American experience in a place like California or Texas.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think about even being in Iowa City, like when I came to Iowa City, Suketu Mehta, who is also an alum of the workshop, passed through a little bit while I was maybe setting up my apartment. And he was like, here is where the Asian grocery store is. Here is where Thai Flavors is. Also, you must go and meet Jim McPherson immediately. And it was sort of like, he was like, there have only been this many South Asians here before. And so we know where all of the things are. And I don't know, it does seem like one of the interesting things also that the book does and that we haven't talked about yet is like it's also a mystery in ways. And there's so much interesting play with that that also I think connects to like what does it mean to set a mystery also in a smaller place? And then also to kind of play off the idea of quote unquote inscrutability of Asian America and like the inscrutability of mystery, which I thought was such an interesting take on genre. It's like my favorite kind of mystery where you're like, who did it, who did it, who did it, who did it? But that's not what the book is about, which is a kind of mystery that I really love.
I mean, one of the things I wanted to do was to describe the way that nobody outside of the Chinese community in Haven actually knows anything about anyone in the Chinese community in Haven. And they don't care until there's this controversial crime that takes place within the community or they think. And suddenly it becomes, you know, internet gossip. It becomes, you know, all over. It goes viral. And suddenly people are seeing them and wondering who they are.
I was just reminded, as you were mentioning this, of my own family kind of laughing at me a little bit for my ability to visit London and see only Tamil people for like an entire trip. Because that was also what I recognized here. And we've been talking a little bit about how narratives about immigration might change and mature, but it's also, you know, even as this kind of great burst of literature and thought is coming out, many of our politicians do not seem to want our discussions of this subject to change or mature in any way. To give you one example, Texas Governor Greg Abbott recently bussed immigrants to D.C. in what was basically a failed publicity stunt, and he's threatening to challenge a 1982 Supreme Court ruling that requires states to educate undocumented children. Are we backsliding in this area, even as families like the Chows kind of are moving forward?
Oh, my God. I'm just spluttering about Governor Abbott. I am just appalled at some of the things going on in Texas. And I shouldn't say that because I'm in a state, you know, in Iowa right now, that seems like a wannabe Texas politically. I just think that there's a willful blindness to the stories of immigrants that is affecting our politics and our country. And all that I can do as a writer is to try to portray stories, genuine stories about human beings, and hope that through narratives, our country can sort of outstrip its politicians in knowledge and wisdom, the people of our country. And, you know, it's interesting, my book, the one thing I'm really happy about it occasionally being marketed as a mystery, because it's not a mystery. And so actual readers of mysteries are confused by it. It's a book with a mystery in it. But I'm glad that people are reading it who don't usually read my books, because I'm hoping that they will sort of appreciate things about the story other than the mystery, and that the book will be read in places where I myself, you know, can't necessarily reach.
That happened to me with my first novel, The Huntsman, where sometimes it was thought of as a mystery. And I was like, I did not realize I was writing a mystery. But
yeah.
Okay.
Okay. You know? Yeah.
But it's so cool because what it does is, I don't know, like I love book, like one of my favorite books, The Hamilton Case by Michelle de Kretzer, does this. It like gets you to collect all of the right information, but for a totally different reason than you thought, which is a sort of structural trick that it's not a trick. It's so much more. It's so satisfying to kind of realize that you've been pointed in the correct direction all along, but without realizing it. So even as these depressing anti-immigrant narratives are dominating the news, I can't help but think of the quieter work that's being done everywhere also to make spaces like the workshop more diverse and equitable and inclusive for immigrants, for LGBTQ folks, for BIPOC students, others from underrepresented groups. And I just have huge admiration for what you've done since being at the workshop on this count.
Thanks,
Suki. I think so many people do. And you started working on this book around the time, I think it was 2005, when you became director of the workshop. And so I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about how working at the workshop and working with students at the workshop affected the book.
Oh, I think that being at the workshop had a huge and wonderful effect on my writing. People say that teaching is bad for writing. In my case, the teaching has cut into my writing time, and the directing has cut also into my writing time. But I think that's the only problem I've had, because for me, I find it an incredibly inspiring place to be here at the program and encountering so many people who are at a point when writing is the most exciting to them is really exhilarating. And I started to sort of go for that feeling when I was writing my own book, looking at my own work, you know, to have that feeling that I'm just discovering something, which I see around me and love. And what it's done is created, I think, a radical change in my tone and narrative for this particular book, because I'm seeking engagement at all times. I always want to be engaged in what I'm doing because I see people around me deeply engaged in what they're doing.
I mean, that makes me, I mentioned earlier that I feel the book is dedicated to James Allen McPherson, who we all studied with, and we talk a lot about him on the podcast. So that sense of engagement and also that sense of humor is reminiscent of him. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about your relationship with him and how that influenced this book.
Sure. I took Jim for my first workshop at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I also sort of audited, quote unquote, his summer workshop just because I wanted to be in that environment during the summer between my 2 years. I found it incredibly nurturing to be around other writers. Jim encouraged me in the direction of the ghost stories that informed Hunger, my first collection. But I would say that for this book, he really influenced me as a person. So he was the funniest teacher I had. I mean, he was always making fun of it at himself. He was making fun at the racist, the Jim Crow culture in which he had been born in Georgia. He made fun of the politically correct corner of the world in which we were all living and working. He was an exceptionally kind person. And, you know, I thought about him a lot as I was drafting The Family Chow. I think he would have enjoyed Leo Chow's dirty jokes. I think he would have enjoyed the general sense of irreverent humor in the book. And I did want to dedicate it to him because I don't know if I could have written this if I didn't know that there was someone I really respected and loved who would read it and laugh. A teacher, you know.
That's okay.
Because others weren't really like him.
No.
I often think of how many rules I broke, of Frank's rules, when I wrote this book and how Frank would have just rolled his eyes. Like Frank once told his son, Tim, that he was only allowed to use 2 exclamation points in his entire life. I guess, you know.
This is Frank Conroy, yeah, the Frank former Conroy. Director of the Iowa Writers Workshop we're talking about. Thanks so much for being here, Sam. And listeners, don't forget to go pick up a copy of The Family Chow or any of Sam's prior books at your local bookseller.
Thank you, guys. It was great to see you.
Thanks so much for being here. That's it for this episode of the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub. The show is produced by Anne Knigendorf. To subscribe to Fiction Nonfiction, please type fiction/non/fiction into your favorite podcast app. We'd love to hear your ideas and feedback. You can reach us at fictionnonfictionpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at FNFTalk, on Facebook at FNFPod, and on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. In each of these places, you'll find links to our LitHub Radio show notes, including some of the readings we mentioned in this episode. You can also find video versions of our episodes on our YouTube channel. Our website, with a full video and audio archive and episodes grouped by theme for educators, is at fnfpodcast.net. We'd love to hear what you're excited to read and watch this summer, so get in touch. Until next time, this has been Fiction Nonfiction from Literary Hub.